Okay, so the title I was given was The Core Collapse Supernova Mechanism, and indeed I will talk about some progress in numerical simulations of the core collapse supernova phenomenon. When you're thinking about astrophysical sources as a way to learn about neutrino properties, there's a little bit of a chicken and egg problem. When you have a neutrino beam from an experiment from which you'd like to learn something about neutrino properties, you would like to understand the properties of your beam. But in the case of core collapse supernovae, of course, nature is pretty stingy with the beam time, giving you about 10 seconds a couple times per century. You would also like to understand the characteristics of your beam, but unlike K to K or Minos, there's not much prospect for building a near detector to measure the properties of your beam at emission directly. So the hope you have is to be able to do some kind of simulation of the supernova process in hopes of understanding the neutrino beam that you're getting. And if you understand your neutrino source, then maybe you can use your understanding of that source to learn something about the neutrinos. Reciprocally, however, we recognize that neutrinos are messengers from deep inside, from deep layers in the supernova environment, and so you can hope to use your detection of those neutrinos to learn something about the supernova itself. So there's kind of this back and forth that goes on between understanding the source and understanding the beam itself, the nature of the particles. And so there has to be some kind of iteration back and forth between those to learn something about both together. Okay, so my talk will be divided into kind of three sections. What are supernovae? This will be some of the same kinds of things that George talked about. This is one of the dangers of speaking in the same afternoon with your thesis advisor. Not only do you tend to dress identically, don't know how that happened, but some of the subject matter can look a little similar too. So then I will also have a little survey of collapse simulations, what's been done, and also talk about a project called the TerraScale Supernova Initiative, which is an initiative over the next few years to try and make a large step forward in supernova modeling. Okay, so what are supernovae? So to begin with a little bit of cultural enrichment, the name supernova dates from the 1930s, but the concept was around in the previous decade, in the 20s. So there was this debate going on about the nature of the spiral nebulae. And once it was realized that the spiral nebulae were separate galaxies comparable to our Milky Way, it was realized that the novae, or new stars seen in them, would have to be much, much brighter than novae appearing in our own galaxy. So during the 20s, these descriptions, giant novae, novae of impossibly great absolute magnitudes, exceptional novae, my personal favorite is the German Hauptnovae, or chief novae in translation. In review articles, Wiki explained that it was deduced that supernovae would be about 1,000 times brighter than common novae based on observations. And he expressed this in terms of these perverse logarithmic units that only astronomers can invent and love. He said that Bodd and I first introduced the term supernovae in seminars and in a lecture course on astrophysics at Caltech in 1931. So that's where the word itself comes from. Astronomers classify supernovae into two basic types based on their spectra. There are type 1s, which show an absence of hydrogen features, and type 2, which have obvious hydrogen features. The type 1s are further subdivided into type 1As, which have a strong silicon feature, or type 1B or C, depending on presence or absence of helium, in addition to absent silicon. There are also some subdivisions of type 2, which I don't really get into. But here in this figure, you can see from some representative spectra, here this top one is the obvious silicon feature in type 1A, the obvious hydrogen features here in a type 2 spectrum, in a type 1b, a helium line here, and in type 1c, an absence of all of these. There are also distinctions based on light curves, but I won't really talk about that much. We've probably had enough observational astronomy. So as far as the physical classification of supernovae, there are two basic physical mechanisms, but they don't line up cleanly with the observational categories of type 1 and type 2. Type 1a's arise from accretion of material from a star onto a white dwarf with which it's a binary. And when enough matter accretes, this is thought to induce a runaway thermonuclear reaction that consumes the entire white dwarf. In contrast, types 2 and 1b and 1c are thought to arise from the core collapse of a massive star. In this case, the presence or absence of the hydrogen or helium, which are the things that distinguish them spectrally, have little or nothing to do with the mechanism. They just have to do with whether the outer layers, outer hydrogen and helium layers, have been stripped from the star during its evolution due to either winds or mass loss to a companion or something. Okay, we'll just pass that by and look in a little more detail at the collapse process. So for most of their lives, massive stars spend their time burning hydrogen into helium. And if the stars are massive enough, then in later stages, as they go, they can burn to higher and higher, heavier elements at smaller radii and heavier densities. So here you see blow-ups into blowing up into regions closer and closer to the center. You see, in addition to the helium that's produced, you get carbon and oxygen, neon, magnesium. Finally, in the innermost layers, you develop a silicon shell and an iron core. And when that iron core gets sufficiently massive, it becomes unstable and collapses. So this is the iron core here. And when it collapses, there's an inner part, denoted in purple here, that collapses homologously and subsonically. And electron capture on nuclei is one of the instabilities leading to collapse. And that process continues throughout the collapse process, producing neutrinos, as indicated by these red arrows here. The outer part of the core in blue is infalling supersonically. And so eventually the inner core reaches a few times nuclear matter density and its collapse is halted by the repulsive hard core of the strong force. But the supersonically infalling outer material doesn't know that, hasn't heard the news, and so when it hits, a shockwave forms. That's here in this thin orange shell and begins to move out. And so the standard lore is that these neutrinos, here the red arrows, coming out of the neutron star, proto-neutron star, heat the material behind the shock and help it to lift off, help it to overcome the energy that's lost from the material behind the shock due to neutrino emission and dissociation of heavy nuclei. So the nascent neutron star here is a hot nuclear bath that contains the energy released, the gravitational potential energy that was released during collapse. And it's a hot thermal bath of nuclear matter and electrons and positrons, photons, and neutrinos. And of course, neutrinos having the weakest interactions are the most efficient means of cooling. And so that's indicated by the yellow or the pink arrows there. And the loss of electron-lepton number from the nascent neutron star gives rise to a composition gradient. Whoops, I want to go back. A composition gradient here in the newly born neutron star. that can give rise to convection in the protoneutron star, and that can help boost neutrino luminosities. In addition, heating falls off the further away you get from the protoneutron star, and that also gives rise to a negative entropy gradient that also can drive convection behind the shock, and that can help increase the efficiency of heating by bringing hotter material up in the vicinity of the shock. So this is kind of the standard neutrino-driven supernova mechanism. So one important point has to do with the neutrino transport that's going on here. Deep inside the protoneutron star, here, where it's optically thick, even to neutrinos, the neutrino distributions are essentially isotropic because it's a diffusive regime. But as you get out towards the outer layers, the neutrino distributions become more and more strongly forward peaked. In this region outside here, where the important heating and cooling are going on, is a transition region then from isotropy to forward peaking. And you really should know that angular distribution well throughout this region in order to model that accurately. So that highlights the importance of neutrino transport that's angle dependent in addition to being energy dependent. So there are many observables to understand from the supernova phenomenon. First of all is the explosion itself. Now I mentioned that 99% of the gravitational energy released, at least I think I did, comes out in neutrinos, and the kinetic energy of the explosion is only about 1% of that, 10 to the 51 ergs versus 10 to the 53 ergs. The optical display is only about 10 to the minus 5 of the gravitational energy released. So the explosion itself is really a sideshow to the main event, which is really a neutrino event from nature's perspective. The optical display is a trivial detail energetically. Nevertheless, from our anthropocentric chauvinism, our personal point of view, the explosion is what we can see with our inborn detectors, our eyes, and so that's what seems the most sexy. But the neutrinos are really the main event, and so neutrino signatures are very important too. In fact, the detection of neutrinos from supernova 1987A basically confirm this basic paradigm that neutrinos are trapped and radiate away most of the gravitational energy released in the collapse on a time scale of seconds. So that observation was a confirmation of prediction and really a triumph of supernova modeling and understanding. There are many other phenomena, pulsar spins, kick velocities, magnetic fields, gravitational waves, element abundances that are produced, and measurements of various types across the electromagnetic spectrum, infrared, optical, ultraviolet, X-ray, gamma ray, and these can be imaged, or you look at their light curves, their spectra, polarization maps, all kinds of things. Now, core collapse simulations tend to focus on the first few of these phenomena. There's another kind of numerical simulation where an explosion is sort of put in by hand. It's assumed to occur, and then the progress of the shock and modeling its interaction with the outer layers of the star is done to look at some of these kinds of things, the element abundances and electromagnetic observations and so forth. The core collapse tend to focus more on phenomena involving these sorts of observables here. Okay, so let me move now towards a survey of what's been done with collapse simulations. From our discussion of the supernova process, you can see there's several key pieces of physics that have to go into this. First of all, there's the neutrino transport and interactions, which is very important because they dominate energetically the system. You have to treat it with all the spatial dimensionality that's present. I mentioned that you want, ideally you would like to have it depend on both energy and angles to track it as it goes from isotropic diffusion to forward peaked free streaming. You would like to include general relativity and also have a comprehensive list of interactions. Now, it might be disappointing to the participants of the conference that the normal thing is for massless neutrinos to be assumed in these simulations. And the standard thinking there is that the mass differences associated with the solar and atmospheric neutrino phenomena are so small that they don't do anything, probably don't do anything with regard to the core, with regard to the explosion mechanism, and probably not with our process nucleosynthesis either, although something might happen there. So barring some surprise, maybe that LS&D actually is right, or that sterile neutrinos exist and mix in an interesting region, or that maybe the nonlinear interactions of neutrinos with their background could do something interesting. Barring any surprises there, kind of the standard assumption is that massless neutrinos are okay for understanding the explosion mechanism itself. And then for knowing what happens in the outer envelope with the mixing, that's taken care of as a kind of post-processing kind of thing to understand what you see in the detectors back on Earth. Okay, so neutrino transport. Hydrodynamics and gravitation also are central, of course. You'd like it to be in multiple spatial dimensions. In addition to convection in the neutron star or behind the shock that I mentioned, rotating progenitors, rotating cores might have important effects. Generation of magnetic fields may also be important, not something I have listed here explicitly. Ultimately, of course, you would like it to be done in full general relativity. Okay, so there's also the equation of state and composition, treatment of dense matter for the protoneutron star, and the number and evolution of nuclear species. This involves lots of cutting-edge nuclear physics, and there's probably lots of room for improvement there in typical simulations. Also important are diagnostics, namely to account for lepton number and total energy accurately. Remember that the explosion phenomenon is about 10 to the 51 ergs, whereas you're dealing with 10 to the 53 ergs in the problem. So if you lose 1% of your energy, you've lost an amount of energy comparable to the scale of the phenomenon you're interested in. And it's hard to argue that you're saying anything really meaningful about the explosion in that case. So you want to be careful about accounting for energy and also lepton number. Okay, so here's some simulations. Starting in the early 90s, two-dimensional simulations began to be done. The first group, I think, to do so was at Los Alamos, and descended from that is this effort by Fryer and Warren recently to do a three-dimensional simulation. And so here, this is an isosurface of constant velocity. And so these outward-going plumes are flowing out at 1,000 kilometers per second, and then the empty regions are downflows. And explosions have been seen in these series of models. Another group to do simulations in the mid-90s in two dimensions was based at the University of Arizona, and they also saw explosions. Computational restrictions, though, put a serious limitation on these simulations, which was that the neutrino transport was averaged over energy and also over angle, making the neutrino transport of, probably not too accurate. So it's unsure as to how meaningful the explosions are, it could be argued. Another group centered at Max Planck for astrophysics in Garching did simulations where the neutrino luminosity was kind of an inner boundary condition and a parameter that could be dialed. And if they cranked up the luminosity high enough, they saw explosions, as you see in this case here. But again, those are parameterized simulations, so that's not a real serious effort at neutrino transport. A group at Oak Ridge also did two-dimensional simulations in the 90s. They had a different approach to neutrino transport where they kept the energy dependence of the neutrino distribution. But these computations had another limitation, which was that their transport calculation, even though it depended on energy, was averaged in angle over space. So it was spherically symmetric. And in these simulations, explosions were not seen, as you can tell from the receding shock radius here in that series of images. So at the end of the 90s, there was kind of this nagging qualitative difference in the simulations that had been done in multiple dimensions, namely that those that had neutrino transport that was averaged in energy and in angle tended to see explosions, while this other kind of simulation that kept energy dependence but averaged it in space did not see explosions. So kind of a next step that has now been seen in the early part of the millennium is computations in spherical symmetry, but with more sophisticated neutrino transport, that is, that is allowed to depend on both energy and angle. And the price you pay for doing that is that it had to be done in spherical symmetry, at least initially. Pardon?
Are these like one-dimensional?
They're one dimension spatially, but then of course when you take account of energy dependence and angle dependence, in spherical symmetry only one of the neutrino distribution functions, angles, is important. So really it's a three-dimensional problem, even though in space it's in spherical symmetry. So here's a figure from a calculation by the group at Max Planck. And these lines show trajectories of individual mass shells as a function of time. And the heavy curve here indicates the position of the shock, and its stagnation is an indication that no explosion is forthcoming in this model. Another group to do these kinds of simulations in spherical symmetry, but with energy and angle-dependent neutrino transport, was at Oak Ridge. And here you see a similar kind of curve. These two curves are for plots in a relativistic calculation with full general relativity and also Newtonian. The previous one from the Max Planck group was Newtonian gravity. And here you can see that no explosions were seen either. So one notable thing about this, again, is the inclusion of general relativity in all its effects, both in redshift of the neutrinos and trajectory bending. Also, they took very particular care with their energy conservation, taking care that the differencings of the partial differential equations were consistent with energy conservation that they could verify numerically. And that then really starts to build a convincing case once you've accounted for all the energy and made sure you've done so, that the explosions simply are not happening in spherical symmetry. Yeah. Yeah, that's what happens in this case. And I think it's probably generally the case, and I looked at this some time ago in connection with neutron star winds, that redshift actually wins out stronger than the bending in terms of what it does in that respect. However, they had a mistake early on where they were getting explosions, and it turned out that if you have exploding models, the mistake was something that was wrong in the way opacities were coded. Things were, there was a certain regime in the code where neutrinos could pass too freely out of the protoneutron star. And in those phony exploding models, they actually found that the relativistic ones exploded more strongly. So what relativity does isn't really clear-cut. It depends on how early things happen. Early on, relativity can help you and make stronger explosions, but later on it will win and kill you, is what it looks like happens. A group at the University of Arizona has also recently done similar calculations, and they come to the same conclusion. There's no strong line here to show the shock, but it looks like it's about right here where you can see some kind of kinking and no progress there of the shock. Now recently, the Max Planck group has taken their sophisticated transport in spherical symmetry in one dimension and partially applied it to two dimensions. Exactly what they do is kind of complicated, and I won't take the time to describe it, but just say that what they're doing now in two dimensions is better than what has ever been done before in two dimensions. And so here are shown some pairs of trajectories of the shock. They're kind of labeled by a letter here. So here's G1 and G2, N1 and N2, for example. And these pairs, 1 and 2, are one-dimensional and two-dimensional versions of the same simulation with various approximations like different neutrino interactions put in or out, or various terms kept or discarded in the neutrino transport equations. And in all cases, it's the case that the two-dimensional simulations go farther, the shock goes farther than the one-dimensional case. But the only one they saw that exploded was this one here, and that in fact was an explosion that left out terms in the neutrino transport equation corresponding to Doppler shifts of the neutrinos and angular aberration of the neutrinos due to Lorentz boosts. And in leaving out those special relativistic terms, then, in this case, made the difference between an exploding model in two dimensions and a non-exploding model in two dimensions. So that difference there is an indication that the details of neutrino transport do, in fact, matter to the outcome of whether there's an explosion or not. Okay, so in my final section, let me say something about the TerraScale Supernova Initiative. This is an initiative that involves a diverse and experienced investigator team from several institutions, as you can see, something like 17 or 18 principal investigators or so, led up by Tony Mitsikappa at Oak Ridge. The members of this team have expertise in all the necessary areas that you would like to see to do the supernova problem completely, including radiation transport, magnetohydrodynamics, nuclear and weak interaction physics, as well as computer science in such areas as the solution of large sparse linear systems and data management and visualization. This effort is supported by the Department of Energy. It's funded for several years through the Office of Science's SCIDAC program, which stands for Scientific Discovery Through Advanced Computing. There's access to the DOE's TerraScale machines, which feature several times 10 to the 12 bytes of memory and floating point operations per second. There's also access to several other teams funded by the DOE. Each one of these subjects here has its own special team associated with it, funded by the DOE, that this initiative is to interact with and benefit from their expertise. So the mission of this team, and they have accepted it, is to explain the supernova phenomena most closely associated with collapse. So these are things like the successful launch of the shock, namely understand the explosion mechanism, predict neutrino signatures, understand pulsar spins, kick velocities, magnetic fields, gravitational waves, and heavy element, or R-process, produced abundances. So I won't talk about all of that different phenomenology, but I will put up one slide for this conference in particular to pay homage to neutrino signatures. So here's luminosity as a function of time, and I can't even read this. Maybe another luminosity plot. They're all luminosity, okay, as a function of time. The different colors are for various different progenitors here that were used in these simulations. These came from simulations in spherical symmetry. And so there are sort of loose collaborations with people associated with neutrino detectors such as Super Chemio Canda and Snow and other people who are have done a lot of work in supernova detection. I think there's some kind of participation also in the Supernova Early Alert Network. Let me tell you about a couple things that have been done then under the TerraScale Supernova Initiative in the first year or so, just kind of a sampling. One thing that's been done in the first year is computations in spherical symmetry, so spherically symmetric simulations, but with improved electron capture rates. So what's been done here is that they've used rates calculated from a hybrid shell model and RPA calculation, and they have applied those to a nuclear statistical equilibrium distribution of nuclei, as opposed to just a single average mass heavy nucleus, has been done typically in the past. And so there are some differences seen here. These panels show the electron fraction and entropy per baryon and density, velocity. And so this is it. The time slice taken here is the point of maximum excursion of the shock, as far out as the shock gets before when it's stalled. So this difference in the physics here, the new electron capture stuff, doesn't make a qualitative difference. It doesn't cause an explosion, but it does make a quantitative difference. So what happens new is the red curve, and the old is the black curve. So the shock gets about 10 kilometers further, and its point of maximum excursion also occurs about 30 milliseconds earlier. And so those are not great differences, but they're in the right direction for helping it explode. Another interesting thing about this is what these electron capture rates have done as far as the conditions leading towards convection. So here we have the electron density profile and entropy profile, and so it's negative gradients in these that tend toward instability towards convection, and those are combined into what's called the Ledoux criterion for instability, negative values of which are susceptible to this instability towards convection. So the black curve here is with the old electron capture rates. The green and the red are from a calculation using the newer electron capture rates. There are two curves for that to show that it's not just a transient thing, but persists a ways in time. And so you're getting more negative values in the Ledoux criterion here, which could be pointing towards stronger convection, which probably would be helpful as well. Another thing that was done were some recent pure hydrodynamic simulations. So these are not full supernova simulations. They don't have any neutrino transport, don't have a realistic equation of state, but just kind of a mocked up polytrope. But the point here was to try and understand something about the hydrodynamics of the system itself. So a standing accretion shock, which is like the point where the shock stalls in a realistic simulation, that's an analytic solution in spherical symmetry. And that's used as an initial condition to some pure hydrodynamic simulations in two and three dimensions. So this analytic solution is matched up, its parameters are tweaked to make it line up with the density distribution that you get from an actual simulation in spherical symmetry. And that's then used as an initial condition. And then small perturbations are made, and then you examine what happens. So it turns out that there's an instability to the lowest order, the L equals 0, L equals 1 modes here in the system. And what happens is, if you have small deformations in the spherical shock, when matter falls through the shock, it gets a little bit of a lateral kick. And so vorticity is generated there. And that vorticity travels down towards the nascent neutron star, and there generates aspherical pressure waves that go back out and deform the shock further. So it's a feedback loop that develops. And so what happens is, in this process, you get turbulent energy, kinetic energy, and also the average shock radius tends to move out, and this happens at the expense of internal energy in the gas, according to the details when you look at it. So this is a shock moving out, not as a result of neutrino heating or anything else, but just from this pure hydrodynamics instability. It's not clear how important a role this takes in an actual supernova simulation, but still it's something interesting, something that might be contributing in addition to neutrino heating. So another thing that's had to be done in the first year is preparations for doing simulations eventually that have spatially multidimensional energy and angle dependent neutrino transport. So one thing that's been done in preparation for that kind of ambitious simulation is to formulate conservative formulations of general relativistic kinetic theory. Again, the motivation for this is that you've got to have a way to say that you're conserving energy in order to say that you're saying something meaningful about the explosion mechanism. So here's the Boltzmann equation for neutrino distribution functions F. The left-hand side is the represents advection in phase space. That's closely tied just to the propagation of just to classical trajectories of particles. The right-hand side is the collision operator. So this first term has space-time derivatives, and the second term has momentum derivatives. So there you will see energy shifts due to Doppler shifts, gravitational redshifts. You'll also see angular aberrations here due to Lorentz boost of the fluid and gravitational trajectory bending, as well as the use of curvilinear coordinates will contribute here. Now, from the distribution function, you can form a particle number current. It's simply the first momentum moment of the distribution function. And that particle number current obeys a conservation law. Here on the left-hand side, you see its divergence, which makes you see it's a conservation law. And I don't have them up here, but if you take the second momentum moment of the particle distribution, then that's a particle stress energy tensor. And it also has a conservation law. So these conservation laws for number and energy are the things you would want to check against in your code to help you see that you're conserving these quantities. Now, if you compare with the Boltzmann equation in the case of number, you see that here we have right-hand side collision integral. And from the right-hand sides, you can see that I should just be able to integrate over momentum and go from the Boltzmann equation to this number conservation equation. But from the left-hand side, you see it's not obvious how that works out, because you have this is a spatial dependent Lorentz boost outside the spatial derivative, and you've got all this momentum dependent stuff outside the momentum derivative. Whereas here, all the momentum dependent stuff has vanished away, and this coordinate transformation term has come inside the spatial derivative. So clearly there's some cancellation going on there. Now the problem numerically is that if you do base your transport code on a formulation of the Boltzmann equation like this, because of the complicated cancelings that have to go on here to go between here and here, numerically those are not at all likely to follow through in discretized versions. So what would be more desirable are conservative formulations of this that are expressed as a divergence in configuration space and a divergence in momentum space, so that when you integrate over momentum, you transparently lead to these conservation laws. So finding those conservative reformulations of the transport is a little interesting problem there. There is, of course, also the matter of actually building a code to do the transport. The great challenge here is that your solution vector, if you have the resolution you want in configuration space and momentum space, for a two spatial dimension problem, you're talking about 10 to the 9 elements in your solution vector. For a three spatial dimension problem, your solution vector would fill up the entire biggest supercomputers that the DOE has. So it's a very challenging problem. And we have developed a transport solver that takes advantage of the structure of these operators in the transport equation so that you can separate it into space and momentum pieces, separate the problem in such a way that you never have to build this gigantic matrix at once or use it all at once, but just use the pieces you need. So here's a timeline. CyDAQ started in fiscal year 2002 and has 5 years to go. In the first couple years, spherically symmetric models will be produced or have been produced. That's really a 3D problem, remember, when you take space and momentum space together. Axisymmetric models are coming in these middle years, and finally three-dimensional problems in space with three more momentum space variables as well are aimed at out in the final couple years. Okay, so for my first of two concluding slides, this is just my outline again, just to say that supernovae are fantastic playgrounds for all kinds of different physics. All four fundamental forces are involved. Lots of interesting things that are going on and lots of complicated things you have to put into your models. There's been a lot learned in the past, but really there has to be much more to do a complete job, and the TerraScale Supernova Initiative hopes to make a big leap forward in that. Now, when we're at meetings like this, sometimes it's hard to keep up day-to-day with the day-to-day advances in the literature. So as kind of a public service, in my last slide, I wanted to throw up one thing I noticed today in an important organ of the scientific literature, namely the op-ed page of the New York Times. And so there's this interesting article today called The Real Scientific Hero of 1953. So this year is the 50-year anniversary of Watson and Crick's discovery of DNA. This article was saying the real hero is not Watson and Crick, but Enrico Fermi. And the reason why he's the real hero is not for many of the things he's most famous for, but his invention of the, quote, computer experiment, a really computer simulation. He's given credit here in this article as being the first one with collaborators to do this. There's a strong claim, too strong, I would say, made here at the end, that basically we have to do everything by computation. Anyway, in the case of supernova science, at least, large-scale computation is computer experiments, if you will, are an important part of understanding. And so I'll stop there.
I'm curious in this historical chronology. Did Zwicky observe a supernova, or why did he actually, what actually caused them to write this article in 1931?
Well, it wasn't actually an article in 31, but they said that in their seminars. So it was this business of the spiral nebulae, really. So it was realized that the spiral nebulae were separate galaxies. In 1880 or so, a nova, or new star, had been observed in the Andromeda Galaxy, what we know today to be the Andromeda Galaxy. So based on that, if they took that to be a separate galaxy, they realized that its luminosity would have to be far, far greater than novae appearing in our galaxy. Yeah, and the existence of separate galaxies, yeah.
Is there any empirical knowledge of the ratio of successful supernovae to failed supernovae?
You mean, okay, so supernovae that give no explosion or optical display, you mean? I don't think so. I mean, the only way to see a failed supernova would be through its neutrinos. And so, since there's only been supernova 1987A, I don't know that there's any empirical knowledge of what that ratio would be.
The second question is, has anybody seen the diffusive regime in the neutrinos that you described initially in your empirical survey, that there was a diffusive region?
The fact that the neutrinos detected from 1987A were detected over many seconds can be regarded as an empirical confirmation of that diffusive timescale.
I have a naive question. So there's more stars in our galaxy than there are years in the age of the universe. So so if one star went off in the age of the universe, we should see something like 100 supernovas a year in the galaxy instead of one every 30 years. And yet we're told that all of our stars have been processed as supernovas. So what exploded earlier must have been stars with 1,000 solar masses. Is that the way this works?
I don't know the details of the population statistics.
The stars are lower mass than the majority of the stars are lower mass than the initial mass function.
Than our sun.
Which is heavily biased towards the low mass and the low matter explode.
Yeah, it's only stars greater than about 8 solar masses that will give rise to core collapse supernovae, and that is the rare sort of tail of the mass function of stars.
For our process, is it possible that the earlier supernovas, this is the question for Jordan. The earlier supernovas were much larger stars, and therefore the heavy elements were synthesized in a very different condition than you're trying to reproduce with present supernovae.
I think, the question is that once the star is over a certain threshold, say 10 solar masses, something of that order, then it will make an iron core, which will collapse. And then to go beyond that and get something qualitatively different, you have to go to many hundreds of solar masses, probably, so that the collapse is induced probably by the electron-positron parent stability, probably during core carbon-oxygen burning. And that's a very different thing. So we would not expect that thing to make the R process. We don't even know really much about the closures on that. Very, very different from what this is called.
At the beginning of your talk, you mentioned type 1A supernovae, and people tell us that those are standing candles.
Uh-huh.
Is there a way of, do they have a neutrino signal that one could use to confirm that they're standing candles?
That type 2s are standard candles?
1A.
Oh. I think there's very little negligible neutrino emissions from type 1As. So I don't think there's any hope there. Pardon?
Is there any plan to put neutrino oscillations?
Probably for the duration of this project, maybe out in the final couple of years you could put something in for neutrino oscillations. But again, because the known masses and mixings are so small, it makes good enough sense to just do a kind of post-processing on the neutrino distributions you get in deep and evolve those afterwards out to larger radii in order to understand expected neutrino signals.
I have to say that UCSB's main role in this is to do just that.
Yes, and that is something going on in this initiative. But I'm just saying that it's not an integrated yet with the large scale computations, although someday it ought to be, I guess.
I think the question is a good lead in for the next speaker. So let's thank Dr. Carter. So the final